Welcome to FebRow, a culture podcast about all things infectious disease. We use consult questions to dive into ID clinical reasoning, diagnostics, and antimicrobial management. I'm Sarah Dong, your host and a MedPeds ID doc. I'll first introduce Dr. Anshul Khenkre. Anshul is a second-year internal medicine resident at the Montefiore Primary Care and Social Internal Medicine Program. He is interested in a career in ID focused on public health and environmental stewardship. Also joining us today is Dr. Mike Reed. Mike is an associate professor at University of California, San Francisco. He currently serves as the Chief Science Officer for PEPFAR in the Bureau of Global Health Security and Diplomacy in the U.S. State Department. He also serves as Associate Director of the Center for Global Health Diplomacy, Delivery, and Economics at UCSF. All right, so as everyone's favorite culture podcast, we ask our guests to share a little piece of culture. So it's really just something non-medical that makes you happy. So what are you guys bringing today?
Oh, I can start. Yeah. Long-time listener, first-time caller. So excited. I think for me, I did a tour of the Southwest National Parks recently, and I had a lot of hype around Zion and the Grand Canyon, which were incredible, but I loved Arches, the national park, and I just found it so peaceful and beautiful that I will highly recommend it to everybody.
Very cool.
That's awesome. So on an outdoors theme, I recently walked the Camino de Santiago in northern Spain. So 2 weeks ago, I was in northern Spain walking the pilgrimage to Santiago. Long days of walking, conversations with strangers from all over the world. It was really restorative. Also a humbling realization of how at least I need to feel grounded. Did choose a quiet path and Spanish tapas were very restorative. You can't pour from an empty cup, right? And this was a chance to get my cup refilled. It was great.
Yeah. Oh, that's lovely. Now I want to go take a walk outside. So Anshul had reached out with this great idea to have an episode. And luckily, we had some awesome timing because hot off the press, we have heard about the FDA approval of HIV prevention option lenacapavir. And so we're going to talk about that today, but I will go ahead and hand it off to Anshul to take us forward.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really just wanted to talk to Dr. Reed today a little bit about lenacapavir. So just to start, what is lenacapavir and how well does it work?
Yeah, so lenacapavir is a first-in-class HIV capsid inhibitor. It's a novel antiretroviral that targets multiple stages in the HIV lifecycle, including capsid assembly, disassembly, viral release. And for the context of this podcast, it's actually marketed as two different products. There's lenacapavir for treatment, which I think is called Sunlenca in the US, and then as you alluded to, hot off the press, the formulation for prevention, which is called Yeztugo, is now available. It's available as an oral tablet and, more importantly, as a twice-yearly subcutaneous injection. I don't think I'll speak too much about treatment with you today, Anshul, but I'm happy to share more details about the science that has recently emerged around prevention and the use of Len.
Yeah, I think that would be great. Just thinking about how this would potentially apply to a patient. Let's say we have a patient here, I'm practicing in the Bronx, who is interested in transitioning from an oral PrEP regimen to lenacapavir after seeing the news. How easily can we switch her? What's the general availability of lenacapavir?
Yeah. Well, maybe I can start by just reviewing the clinical research that has been published that sort of supports its use, and then I can answer your questions around its clinical role in a place like the Bronx. Late last year, at the end of 2024, the scientists who were working on LEM published two papers, Purpose 1 and Purpose 2, both published in the New England Journal. Purpose 1 looked at the role of Len as a prevention tool for cisgender women in sub-Saharan Africa. They evaluated Len in a setting of very high HIV incidence in Uganda and South Africa, and they basically randomized participants to either getting injectable Len every 6 months or oral Truvada, which, as you know, is the gold standard for biomedical prevention. And they looked at outcomes over a 12-month period. And in that study, and this is one of the most groundbreaking pieces of science, I think, published in many, many years, they found zero HIV infections in the Len arm. So an HIV incidence that was statistically indistinguishable from zero, which has never been found before in a prevention trial. For the purposes of your question, I think it's worth just highlighting purpose two, though. So purpose two, very similar study design, but this was in men and gender diverse people, mostly in the US, I think 60 research sites in the US, and then about 30 research sites across Brazil, Thailand, South Africa, Peru, Argentina, I think there may have been one other country. And again, they randomized individuals in that trial to Len every 6 months or oral Truvada. And what they found there, again, was incredibly impressive results. Essentially, two infections in the Len group among 2,100 participants. And that represented a 96% reduction in HIV risk compared to background incidence. So much higher superiority as compared to the oral option, Truvada. And I think key takeaways, which are, again, relevant to your patient in the Bronx, near perfect prevention in purpose one, 100% efficacy and 96% efficacy and statistical superiority in purpose two over daily oral PrEP. Wow, this is unheard of in HIV research. I think the other thing to highlight that is, again, relevant to your patient and also validated by a fair amount of other research, though, is that Truvada, whilst an effective agent, is only as good as it is when people take it. And in Purpose One, many people just didn't take it, or they didn't take it continuously during the research period. And I think that speaks to the potential value of Len as something where adherence really isn't the same challenge, because you're just getting an injection every 6 months, and that injection offers sustained protection. I think the other insight that, again, is relevant is just that this was very well tolerated. There were mild injection site reactions, some inflammation, a little bit of pain. But overall, almost everybody continued the Len throughout the research period. So for your patient in the Bronx, and I will say I was a resident in the Bronx, I totally appreciate that client context. Yeah, I think the potential to use this drug is very high. I think this could have a really transformative impact for folks who are at greatest risk of HIV acquisition. And not only those that have a harder time taking pills, everybody, the research shows everybody benefited. Two things I'll say, and then I'll let you ask your next question, Anshul. Purpose One and Purpose Two are just two trials in a family of trials that the drug company have sponsored. Purpose Three, Four, and Five will explore the role of Len in cisgendered people in the US. I think that's three. Purpose Four is looking at Len in people who inject injection drugs, and Purpose Five is looking at Len in Europe and the UK. So there are still some important unknowns about its potential impact in those populations. Look, I would imagine that it will be very efficacious in those contexts too, but we will wait on those data, some of which will be published pretty soon, to confirm that. The other answer to your question, though, about is it a good option for somebody in the Bronx is it available, right? And I think this is the really exciting thing. So on June 18th, the FDA approved Len for prevention under the brand name Yeztugo. Don't know how they come up with these names for new drugs, but it is what it is. And I think people have started to prescribe it. I think the first drug prescription was soon thereafter. Nonetheless, I think a major challenge is ensuring that insurance companies and patient assistance programs make the drug available. I understand that Gilead have committed to broad access. They have like an advanced access program to reduce costs for clients. But I imagine that it will be a few months before it's actually available and on insurance schemes, etc. The last thing I'll say, and I'm not an expert on drug pricing in the US, but I think it will be quite expensive to begin with. The reports I've read are that in the US, Yeztugo will be priced annually at between $28,000 and $42,000. And so that may be prohibitive for some, although I understand that they priced it at that level with the expectation that insurance companies will be able to cover that for many people. So there's a long answer to your short question. Happy to revisit any of the pieces that weren't clear.
No, I think that was extremely clear. I think it really is amazing that we have this FDA approval now. And I think the cost overall is something that everybody seems to be questioning. But as people start to prescribe, I think we're going to see where it lands and kind of advocate from there. I think a similar question, just because you referenced the Purpose One trial, was conducted in sub-Saharan Africa. If we were in a clinic in rural Uganda, what kind of access to lenacapavir would potentially be seen? And then on top of that, this can be a little bit contentious, but how has the PEPFAR freeze and subsequent defunding affected the ability to roll out a drug like lenacapavir, which has been so incredibly effective?
Yeah, it's a great question. Both of those are great questions. I think up until recently, there was great optimism that Len would be widely available in sub-Saharan Africa in the imminent future, contingent on FDA approval. I think there is still optimism that lenacapavir will be available in sub-Saharan Africa in the imminent future. But I think it's fair to say that the incoming administration have taken a different approach to global health than past administrations, Democrat and Republican. And as you alluded to, Anshel, they instituted a pause on foreign assistance early in January after President Trump returned to power. And that pause on foreign assistance has had quite substantial impacts on the program that I'm involved with, PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And specifically, we initially saw a pause of all programming and then quickly thereafter a resumption of life-sustaining activities. So within a few days of that initial pause after January 21st, we were able to resume much of the activity that had been undertaken before that, as long as it was related to care and treatment and other life-sustaining activities. However, there was a pause on all prevention activities that was sustained, and that has had an impact on our capacity to support biomedical prevention programming in high-burden countries that PEPFAR had previously supported. I'll also say that to execute the programs that we fund has been concomitantly challenged by the dissolution of USAID as one of our implementing agencies. And so whilst some of our programming that has been funded through other US agencies like the CDC has resumed, some of the programmatic activities undertaken by USAID, particularly related to prevention, have not been resumed. So all of those things have had a big impact. Perhaps we can include in the links to this podcast some of the great science that has been done to try and evaluate that. There have been 10 or 20, maybe 30 really great modeling papers that have been produced that have tried to assess the impact on the pause in foreign assistance on HIV outcomes, mortality, incidence, as well as on other diseases, including tuberculosis, malaria. I just draw your attention to one as a great paper that's published in Lancet HIV by Den Brink et al. About 3 months ago that estimated that if that pause was continued after January in perpetuity, then there would be 3 million additional deaths by 2026 from HIV. But there are a number of other papers out there that have similarly kind of evaluated either at country level or across sub-Saharan Africa the impact of the pause on programs. There's even a website you can go to. There's the PEPFAR Impact Counter website, which is produced by colleagues at Boston University that tries to track in real time the impact of these pauses on clinical programs. And I think we might be able to share the link to that in the notes of the podcast. So that all brings me back to your question around the person in Uganda who would be interested in Len. And I think the question is, no, right now there is no ability to make Len available. for a couple of reasons. One is that we're still in this place where the current administration haven't determined what their policy is vis-a-vis supporting prevention programming. And two, because the drug is not yet available in sub-Saharan Africa. And at the point where it is, the question remains as to whether it will be affordable for the ministries of health to procure with their own resources. Maybe I'll just reflect on some other data that has been published that speaks to the excitement and I think desire of recipients of care in sub-Saharan Africa to access long-acting agents. So there's a research group actually from the University of California, San Francisco, the SEARCH group that work in Kenya and Uganda, and they have looked at willingness of individuals to switch from Truvada to cabotegravir, which is another long-acting agent, and found that in that setting, almost everybody, the vast majority of people, when given the choice, moved from oral to injectable. And one would anticipate that the same is true for Len, that if available, it will be willingly and excitedly pursued by individuals who would benefit from it. And we can spend a little bit of time dwelling on this next reflection if it's useful. But I think one of the key issues for sub-Saharan Africa is not so much related to the efficacy. We know based off of Purpose One that this is an incredibly efficacious drug for prevention, but really the cost effectiveness. And the cost effectiveness will be determined by what price Len is available at and the volumes that are procured to ensure that that price is affordable, and then also the incidence. So there is a fair amount of modeling that's also been done to try and anticipate where Len will have the greatest impact in high burden settings. And I think initial rollout modeling suggests that if we were able to roll out between 1 and 6 million person years of Len over a 3-year period, then that could avert up to 100,000 infections in sub-Saharan Africa. That's actually a relatively small fraction of the global incidence, but it's a vital step towards sort of broader adoption. The places where Len will be most cost effective are the places of highest incidence. So in sub-Saharan Africa, that really will mean South Africa, which has the highest HIV incidence in sub-Saharan Africa, and there are a number of districts with very high incidence where ideally Len would be targeted. And then there are other smaller pockets in many other countries in sub-Saharan Africa where, if targeted to the right priority populations, it would again be cost effective. And then similarly in the Philippines, you may know that there is a sort of a really rapidly unfolding HIV epidemic in the Philippines right now. And that would be a place where there would be a likelihood of high impact in the near term. Now, the other thing to say is that that impact will diminish over time, right? So that as incidence goes down, the cost will go up. That is a sort of a paradox that we would have to deal with. But nonetheless, the key message is that yes, effective. Yes, cost effective in the right settings, and it all comes down to what the price is. And I haven't spoken to the price, I'm happy to. The cost savings potentials exist when the price for Len is around $40 to $60 per year. Len would be cost saving in those highest burden settings. And that's compared to, so when they do these assessments of cost effectiveness, they compare it to the lifetime cost of antiretroviral therapy, right? So because of the amazing work of PEPFAR over the last 20 years, antiretroviral therapy in high burden, low income settings is really cheap. A year's supply of TLD, which is tenofovir, lamivudine, dolutegravir, costs $40 a year. So it's actually not that expensive an intervention. So if you want a prevention intervention that is more cost effective than ART, then it has to be cheaper than the 20 years of TLD. And so what that means is a cost of closer to $40 to $60 per year. I have two more reflections and then I'll answer your next question if there is one, Anshul. But there is some really exciting data that has been shared but not peer-reviewed, including a paper that is currently under review with Lancet HIV, suggesting that generic drug companies could develop lenacapavir at a cost of less than $25 per person per year in the near future. So what that means is that the cost of the goods, the cost of manufacturing could be reduced substantially from the cost that the originator, Gilead, are making it at to a really affordable price, $25 a year. And $25 a year would be very affordable in many high-burden countries. The caveat there is that for the generic drug companies to make it available at that affordable price, there have to be sufficient volumes. They're not going to make it at $25 per prevention year if only 100,000 people in sub-Saharan Africa are on it. They'll be able to make it at those cost-effective prices when the volumes are really, really high. So when there are more than 10 million people on prevention per year. And so there, we end up in a kind of a chicken egg, you know, conundrum where you need that early adoption of Len, probably from procurement of the Gilead formulation, the originator formulation, to start to drive the market so that generics know that there is an appetite for this drug. So they then go out and develop more and do so at a price that is affordable. To their credit, Gilead have said, we want this drug to be widely available in sub-Saharan Africa, and we are going to make the license available to several different generic drug manufacturers. So I think they've made their license available to six generic drug companies right now, who in theory are going to be able to run with it, figure out how to make it as effectively and cheaply as possible. But those generic companies need a market, right? And they're not going to jump in unless they know that there is a market for this drug, which brings us back to this challenge that who's going to pay for Len in the first place? And historically, that has been the US government through PEPFAR, as well as the Global Fund, which is a multilateral donor initiative that includes funding from the US government, but also from many other high-income countries. The Global Fund have said, yes, we are very interested in investing in Len, and they are going to procure it and make it available. I am very hopeful that this US administration sees the value of Len as a prevention tool that will help us control the epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa and is worth investing in. But that remains to be seen at this time. If they do, I think the investments from the US government and Global Fund could be really catalytic in driving down the prices to a point at which they become more affordable. But ultimately, and this is my last reflection, we're moving into a different time in global health where the role of donors like the US government, like Global Fund is evolving. And there is increasing consensus that many countries, particularly middle-income countries, should be funding their own HIV response. And in that context, there are many countries in sub-Saharan Africa with a high HIV burden that will and should invest more in the prevention programming that is ongoing in their countries rather than relying on donors to support that. And for those countries, I think there is a real challenge here in terms of persuading them that Len makes sense, particularly when you're comparing Len to Truvada, which is less than $40 a year, or to condoms, which are very effective and even more affordable, right? And so this is the calculus that ministers of health and ministers of finance have to deal with. I'll just say one last thing. Even for those politicians, though, the dividend of Len in particular high incidence priority populations is very compelling. So if you can target Len to those pockets of highest incidence, whether those are people who inject drugs, men who have sex with men, professional sex workers, and then some communities of adolescent girls and young women with high HIV incidence, then you could still have a very impactful and cost-effective intervention. The challenge there is to sort of identify those pockets and then with precision allocate the Len in ways that ensure that you're getting not only clinical bang for your buck, but also financial bang for your buck. And I think there's some really interesting science that we need to do there around predictive tools, maybe the role of AI, et cetera, determining how we allocate a drug like Len. Finally, in sub-Saharan Africa, we have a generalized epidemic, right? It's quite different from the US, where we have an epidemic that is really concentrated in small pockets. And in that generalized epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa, the risk of HIV acquisition is fairly heterogeneous. And so that makes it harder to determine who is going to benefit most from it. Certainly in priority populations, we know that LEM will have value. But in that heterogeneous context, it's more like finding a needle in a haystack. You do have to scale interventions large to see that benefit when that risk is so heterogeneous. So which again adds to this paradox of where LEM will have the greatest value. That was a really long-winded way of answering your short question. So I hope that got some of the answer that you were after.
No, not at all. I think that was truly fantastic. And I appreciate a lot of the insights you provided. I did want to also highlight specifically the removal of 100,000 people from the pipeline of screening, diagnosis, and treatment. So really like taking them entirely out of that pipeline, even though it may seem like a smaller number of people, it goes a long way at curtailing the overall epidemic. I also wanted to highlight some international advocacy organizations that really helped push for the generic manufacturing of lenacapavir. I put a link to the People's Medicine Alliance, and I think that a lot of countries in sub-Saharan Africa where this drug was tested had community-based organizations come together and advocate for themselves and really strongly push for this, as you said, life-saving drug. And we talk about it being life-saving. I do want to ask if you have any concerns about the use of lenacapavir. We've really highlighted the pros, and I think for very good reason. But anything in the implementation that we need to be conscious of, aside from the cost effectiveness?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are a couple of things that are worth highlighting. From a biomedical point of view, I think a potential concern relates to resistance, right? So as a first-in-class capsid inhibitor, LEN represents a novel mechanism, which also means that we have limited real-world data on resistance patterns, and particularly in settings of imperfect adherence or delayed HIV diagnosis. It remains to be seen whether we need to be concerned about the potential of LEN resistance. I will just add to that a caveat that in sub-Saharan Africa, LEN is not available for treatment. In the near term, if it's available, it will only be available for prevention. So the issue of resistance may not be such a big issue in those settings, but I can imagine that in a place like the US where LEN is going to be used as part of treatment and prevention, then it will be important to consider the potential development of resistance. And you can mitigate that challenge by ensuring that as it's scaled with safeguards, right? So that means reliable HIV testing before initiation and then monitoring on LEN. And as with anybody who's on oral Truvada or cabotegravir, they need to continue to get tested whilst taking that prevention modality to ensure they haven't developed HIV whilst on the drug and therefore at risk for resistance. I'm not so worried about resistance in sub-Saharan Africa, though. I think that the biggest concern for me is really about how do we get to scale and do so affordably so that ministries of health are able to procure it. That's the biggest challenge that we probably face in the near term for places where I work.
Thank you so much, Dr. Reed. I just wanted to ask for people who are listening, how did you get into this role? And can you describe a little bit more about PEPFAR in general?
Sure. I finished residency at arguably the best residency program in the country at Montefiore Primary Care Social Medicine Program. I'll just throw that out there. And actually knew then that I wanted to do global health. I was really interested in issues of justice and equity, preferential care for the poor and underserved. And immediately after residency, worked in a PEPFAR program in sub-Saharan Africa. First living in New York and then moving to and living in Botswana. I'll just mention what PEPFAR is and I'll come back to it again. So PEPFAR is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. It's the US government's flagship program for assistance for HIV, established in 2003 by George W. Bush, and has had an unprecedented impact on the HIV epidemic. More than 25 million people's lives have been saved. More than 20 million people are on treatment right now through PEPFAR, and over $110 billion of aid has gone to partner countries during that period. And at the time that I did residency, PEPFAR was a very morally compelling program that I wanted to be all in on. And so out of residency, I worked in a funded program in Manhattan at Columbia University, and then moved to Botswana and lived there for 4 years, where I worked as an HIV physician. And you know, it was great. Like, on the one hand, I was able to see how care was delivered. I was providing HIV care in rural Botswana. But on the other hand, it was fairly jarring to be in a setting where me as a UK-trained, American-paid physician was delivering care, while I was surrounded by people who were far better clinicians than me, but didn't have the resources. And it really got me thinking about, how do we improve the health systems in these countries so that they're able to respond to HIV? So I did that for 5 years and realized, actually, I wanted to do more training. And I was very interested in, how do you optimize health systems in high HIV burden settings, and that ended up doing fellowship after 5 years away. Did ID fellowship. By the time I'd finished ID fellowship, I was deep in the weeds on how do you optimize health systems, and that led to my subsequent career doing health policy research in the HIV space. Fast forward 10 years, and now I work as the chief science officer for PEPFAR, really trying to deliver on my own ambition to support and improve health systems in those countries.
Yeah, I just wanted to open up to just the last question for you, Dr. Reed. Anything that you can recommend for folks who are interested in global health in the future, and folks who are interested in advocating for lenacapavir's implementation broadly going forward?
Yeah, brilliant question. I love that question. So let me zoom out and say, I think global health is an inflection point right now. We're at a point where there is a change of political priorities around the importance of global health. I think political attention is waning, and some of that moral ambition that led to PEPFAR being established is waning in places like the US. And there is a really important responsibility on people that care about these issues to make a loud, effective noise in support of initiatives like PEPFAR. PEPFAR has had an incredible impact over the last 20 years, but to sustain that impact, I think, does require ongoing political investment from our leadership. And I think this is a really critical time for people interested in global health to exercise their advocacy and protesting capabilities to ensure that we continue to prioritize global health in settings like the US, which historically has been the funder of a substantial global health program. And so I think there is a considerable value in folks like you, Anshul, telling your congresspeople and senators about the importance of PEPFAR. You know, as to the role of lenacapavir, again, there is no doubt that len is incredibly efficacious clinically. But unless we're able to show that it's cost effective, then that clinical efficacy won't be realized on the ground in the places that need it most. And in order for us to get to that point where it's cost effective, again, I think there is real need for advocacy and ambition to ensure that we procure the volumes necessary in the first instance from Gilead to make it available, and that motivates the generics to invest so that the price comes down to a point at which partner governments can afford it. So for all of those reasons, I think there is a role for folks like you advocating for Len. I'll just say one last thing. Some of these things I write about on my Substack. You can find out more about my opinions on this and many other things at reimagineglobalhealth.substack.com.
Thanks so much to Anshul and Mike for joining us today. You can find more info on our website, febrilepodcast.com, where we house the consult notes, which are written supplements to the episodes with links to references. our library of ID infographics, and a link to our merch store. Febrile is produced with support from the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Please reach out if you have any suggestions for future shows or want to be more involved with Febrile. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and I'll see you next time.